Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We are scheduled to have with us today the McFarland High School students. Are they here? Will they please stand? Thank you for coming under any conditions, especially this morning's conditions. You may be seated. These students are with us with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. All high school students are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if the school accepts the invitation, these students are given briefs of the case that they will hear, and they may engage in some outside activities relating to this case. And then, as part of the program, the students meet with a justice who is assigned for the day to discuss the case, and they do this after the second case in the morning. Everyone is invited to join the justice and the students at noon. The discussion will be about the procedures of this court, not the substantive issues that are involved in the cases. So with those preliminary remarks, let me introduce the court to you. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice who will meet with the students and whoever else wishes to meet today. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, please raise your hand. The marshal has summaries, and it's easier to listen if you know something about the case. Just raise your hand. Okay, good. Anyone else like a summary? All right. I'm going to call on this first case, 2005, AP 1487, State of Wisconsin, ex rel. Kevin Thomas versus David H. Schwartz et al. Arguing before us is Assistant Attorney General Christopher G. Wren. Mr. Wren, you may proceed.
Honor, may it please the court. I think I'd like a summary of that case because I think we're all feeling.
I think we might all need it. Wait until you get the questions, Mr.
I just feel late, Enrique.
Well, after I do my introduction, I have a suggestion for the court about how to simplify and maybe understand this a little better.
Court always likes simplification.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
We always like simplification.
When the court decides this case, there are certain things that the state would like or the respondents would like the court to do. Obviously, the first thing we want is for the court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision. In doing so, we specifically ask that the court hold that the Department of Corrections and the Division of Hearings and Appeals had the authority under the statutes to simultaneously revoke parole and extended supervision in these circumstances. Second, to hold that the Court of Appeals should have accorded the DOC and DHA great weight deference rather than no deference in interpreting the sentencing and revocation statutes. If the court, however, concludes that Mr. Thomas's interpretation is correct and the Court of Appeals was correct, we ask that the court remand the case to the Division of Hearings and Appeals to allow the administrative law judge to redo the reconfinement determination portion of the revocation decision. We're not asking for a new revocation hearing. I don't believe Mr. Thomas
What does that mean? Remand to the DOC to what?
To reconsider the reconfinement determination. In this case, the ALJ decided that because both the parole and the extended supervision could be revoked simultaneously, She decided not to take any from the parole and to recommend to the circuit court that all of the reconfinement time be taken from extended supervision. If the court concludes that the Court of Appeals was correct in its determination, that would be an error of law on the part of the ALJ in terms of deciding where the reconfinement time could be taken from.
So, in effect, what she would do is decide on parole reconfinement,
right.
Forget extended supervision, forget any change in reconfinement on the basis of resentencing on extended supervision.
That's correct, yes.
One of the questions that's going to come up is, and maybe now is not the time, but what difference does it make to the defendant or the state when you view the extended supervision and parole can be revoked at the same time? I mean, how does that change how much time spent in prison, how much time spent on extended supervision? What does it do to further release on parole from the prison under the indeterminate sentence? Do you know what I'm asking?
I think so. There are multiple questions there, I believe. Perhaps
they're all the same question, though.
Well, it's a varying configuration. In a sense, I think what you're asking is what would be the effect of the court's decision on release dates, depending on how this plays
out. And generally, not only for this prisoner, but any prisoner.
I can help resolve that by making my simplification point of this.
Okay,
here.
Good.
Over the weekend, during my moot court on Friday, one of my colleagues, Don LaTaraca, suggested a way of understanding the configuration of the relationships among indeterminate sentencing, determinate sentencing, and what I would call the hybrid or transitional sentencing, where you have consecutive sentences in both. And he sketched out a little chart that I worked on over the weekend. I shared it with Mr. Kaiser. He had some disagreements with it, but we came to an agreement that the chart helped both us and might help the court.
All right.
We have both prepared charts, a little table.
That's what we need, another chart in this case, right?
If the court's interested, we have provided enough copies for the court to look at.
Why don't you give it to them? Mark which one is yours and which one is
I think they're labeled at the
Mr.
top
Kaiser.
so that it's clear.
Is that all right with you, Mr. Kaiser? Okay.
While she's distributing the chart, I have this is a very practical question as far as the number of people. As I recall in the argument, someone made it either the one side or the other. I think it probably was a state that this will eventually affect hundreds, maybe thousands of sentences. Is that what I was looking at? There aren't that many people. You know, we're looking at pre and post TIS situations. Is this the argument was made? This is a very important decision in that area as far as what's going to happen and the number of people it will affect.
Both Mr. Kaiser and I made inquiries of the Department of Corrections on this during the course of the following the oral argument in the Court of Appeals. Department of Corrections was not able to give us exact numbers by any means, but what they told me was that because of, you know, for various reasons, because a lot of people who get consecutive sentences now were on parole, for instance, at the time and then violated under TIS, the numbers are certainly in the hundreds, and their view is that they believe that they're in the thousands. They don't track it that way within the department. They don't have a database that tracks it. I don't have an explanation for that, but they did say that there was a way they could extract it, but it would cost a lot of money. And both Mr. Kaiser and I think reached the independent conclusions that the amount of money involved was rather substantial and beyond what either of our parties was prepared to invest in this. But my understanding is from the Department of Corrections that there will, as TIS moves farther and farther along and we get more and more either revocations or reversals of indeterminate sentencing cases, we're going to see more and more cases where we have these hybrid sentencing structures on consecutive sentencing. So from the Department of Corrections point of view, from the respondent's point of view, this is a very important case because they've already had a lot of instances of revocations under with consecutive sentences in this arrangement. This is simply the first one that has wound up in court. The second thing, the second difficulty is, and the second that I think is that under the Court of Appeals interpretation, this beads on a string notion plays out rather creates a lot of calculation or computation problems for the Department of Correction. If the Court of Appeals decision stands, and that's one of the, and it's the anomaly of the way the this computation occurs in this hybrid period, this transitional period, as opposed to how computation is handled in the pure regimes of
internal. That's what I'm asking you in my long question. What is the computation? Why is it complicated? And how does it differ from one versus the other? Now the courts. Mr. Kaiser, the court has received only the state's view, and I gather when you get up, you will give us your chart. Yes. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
What we have here is basically a 3x2 table, and each column indicates the sentencing regime we're talking about. From the state's point of view, 5 out of those 6 cells all reflect the computation as the language has in both pure under, well, as you can see in the first cell, for instance, on the first row, all consecutive sentences shall be computed as one continuous sentence. And the same language is used for determinant-only sentencing. All consecutive sentences shall be computed as one continuous sentence. We treat in the middle block under transition, because the specific language in 973.15, the statute that's cited there, says that when you have consecutive sentences from both the indeterminate period and the determinate period, the confinement time is served consecutively without a break. We regard that as a continuous sentence. So the real dispute here is what happens when you get to supervision time. And the Court of Appeals basically said, that's not continuous. That's not treated as continuously. It has to be as a continuous sentence. It has to be treated as what they call the beads on a string, so that each separate supervision period for each separate sentence has to be revoked separately, and it's not treated continuously. From our point of view, that has a number of flaws. One is it's highly anomalous. It would treat that specific supervision period entirely differently from the way both confinement time and supervision time are treated throughout the rest of the sentencing regime. It makes no sense from our point of view. It makes the computations rather problematic.
Here's my question.
Okay.
In your chart, you say indeterminate only pre-TIS. All consecutive sentences shall be computed as one continuous sentence. You got 3 dots. That means you're looking at the new version of 3?
What we're looking at is when they inserted the language to say to differentiate determinate from.
But my point is, yeah, pre-revision of 302.11.3, 302.11.3 said all consecutive sentences shall be computed as one continuous sentence.
Yes.
That was revised in 2001-2.
Right.
To be all consecutive sentences imposed for crimes committed before TIS.
Right.
Shall be computed as one continuous sentence. Now, my understanding from your briefs is that you view 302.11.3, the new version, the post-2001 version, as applying to this case. Is that correct?
It applies to that sentence. For the crime that he occurred pre-TIS, yes.
Yeah. But in this case, he was pre-TIS, but the revocation was post-TIS, right?
Right.
And does 302.11.3 apply to him, the new one?
Well.
And why does a new statute that applied to a case that was pre-TIS, and many of the factors here occurred pre-TIS? So it's retroactive?
Well, perhaps I should. The language, the ellipsis represents the language that was inserted that makes the difference between the two, which simply identifies the application of this sentence, of this paragraph, to make clear that it's distinguishing between.
All right. I'll start again.
Okay.
The new 302.11.3. The new 302.11, mm-hmm. paren 3 paren, applies in this case, in your view?
Not the new one, the old one.
The old one applies.
Yes, I'm sorry. The difference between, there's functionally, from our point of view, there's no difference between the new and the old because they're both identifying the same crime to which it applies.
You explain that at great length, I think, in pages 25 to, is it 25 to 26 of your brief? Let's see if I can find that. Maybe it's 29 to 30, where, and then 32 through 34, where you say, hey, these are only, they really explain, they're the same thing, they merely are explanatory, they're no different.
From our point of view, that's correct, that because of the effective date of TIS, if this statute, if this language is simply said, all continuous sentences should be computed without any reference to a date, the assumption would have been that would have applied to everything.
Right.
Now, what they apparently...
But there was a date.
There was a date, as
right.
there was in the date in the corresponding statute under the determinant only, the 302.113 sub 4. The same language is used, they just have different dates as to which crimes they apply to. And all that's doing is making clear that those particular, that to the extent that you've got sentencing that's occurring after the effective date of TIS 1, it's distinguishing between sentences that are imposed for a crime that occurred before TIS mm-hmm. and crimes that occurred mm-hmm. afterwards. But the functionally, whether you have that date in there or not for the pre-TIS crime doesn't have any impact. It's the question is how it's computed.
That's your explanation in your briefs.
Pardon?
That is your explanation in your briefs.
That's what I thought I was explaining.
Right. Okay.
I hope that's what I was explaining.
Could I ask a different question? The first offense here, we have a date of August 17th, 1999. That's the two forgeries? Conviction.
I believe that's correct, yeah.
That's your... indeterminate sentence.
Yes.
Okay, then there's a determinant sentence on April 6th, 2000.
That's correct, yes.
And as a result of that determinant sentence, there's the challenge incarceration program. Is that not right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now that program is completed.
Yes.
And in August 2001, defendant is released.
Right.
And there are several places where that's released on parole, references to that. You could disagree with that.
Okay. Yeah.
It seems to me the language on page 3 and the language on page 5 of your brief indicates that the December 31, 1999 date does not become effective until July 30th, 2002. Footnote. Footnote 2, page 3.
Right.
Okay. So that July 30th, 2002 is after August 2001, isn't the defendant released on sort of continuous sentence in August 2001?
Well, to get back to Chief Justice Abramson's point about...
Same question, but spelled out.
Question. It's what really applies in his case is 302.11 pre-amendment. The amendment adds the date. That effective date of TIS, but it doesn't have any functional change in terms of when he's of entitlement to release on an indeterminate sentence case. In other words, under 302.11 sub 1 sub 2 that statute, as soon as he completed his confinement time, on both of the sentences that he was in for at that time, he was entitled to immediate release, both on parole, which is the mandatory release, the MR, and on extended supervision. But 302.11, pre-amendment, applied at that time and had the same effect as if it had occurred afterwards. I mean, there's no functional difference in terms of his entitlement to release.
Wouldn't the factual dates be significant even if there were a clear-cut change in the law in July 30th, 2002?
I'm not sure what from the point of view of whether he's entitled to release, I'm not sure what the difference would be. And I'm sorry if I'm not understanding the question, but he's in prison on two counts, on two charges.
Yeah.
One is an indeterminate pre-TIS sentence. The other is a determinate TIS sentence. He comes up for release after TIS 1.
Released on parole.
He's released on parole, but he's also...
Your position is he's also released on extended supervision because extended supervision comes into effect full-blown instantly after confinement is satisfied.
That's correct.
That's your position.
There are two statutes that relate to the entitlement to release. One, it has to do with mandatory release parole under the pre-TIS sentencing. The other has to do with entitlement to release on extended supervision for determinate sentences. Both of them say that once you have served your confinement time, you are entitled to immediate release under that. The Seventh Circuit has held that that language creates a liberty interest. The Court of Appeals has also made a similar finding or similar holding. What creates the immediate right to release in this point under both is this middle period where he's in a consecutive sentences for both the pre-TIS and the TIS period, and the confinement time for both by statute has to be served before any release can occur under either parole or ES. The two statutes provide for immediate release on both when the confinement time is served. That was Judge Fine's point in his dissent in this case, that because you're entitled to immediate release, you can't treat it as beads on a string. It has to be seen as one continuous period, or else it has to be seen as concurrent time that's being served, which would be anomalous in a consecutive sentence situation.
Counsel, indeed, you said that's what the fine said. It's immediate release, and I should have counted the times that you said the statute says immediate release 14 times, I'll say. So let's take a look at 302.113(2). And show me, and I guess I ask this rhetorically, obviously the word immediate doesn't appear there, does it? And so isn't that what part of the fight between the majority and the dissent was and is in this case? That it says after. And that makes all the sense in the world after.
Right.
That is, you're not going to serve your extended supervision, well, it makes sense to me, you know, before your confinement period. You're going to serve it after your confinement period. The
right.
question is, when after? And you read in the word immediate that doesn't appear there, and maybe that's a reasonable read-in, but I'm saying you read it in, and your opposing counsel would say it's after, obviously, but not immediately after. And that's, it seems to me, one of the big differences between the majority and the dissent in the Court of Appeals.
I think that's correct. But I think that because we have court decisions, we have a Seventh Circuit decision, Felci versus Fiedler, and a State ex rel Olson, both say that language creates the liberty interest in release, and the DOC does not have any choice but to release immediately under that language. So if we don't read in immediately, then we're depriving of the liberty interest.
Now the argument contrary to that is, that's a reasonable argument. The argument contrary is, hey, what do the statutes mean and what kind of scheme were we building here? And you look to the Criminal Penalty Study Committee, and they had a very different approach that was in part vetoed by Governor McCallum. But they not only thought that extended supervision and parole were not one in the same, but their recommendation to the legislature was, knowing that they are distinct, they said, that we want you to do extended supervision before parole. And then that was the language. So their statutory scheme envisions distinct concepts, and one served after the other.
And they were wrong. And Judge Brennan, in one of his articles, said they were under the mistaken impression that extended supervision had stricter supervisory standards than parole did. And DOC has said consistently, no, they are the same thing. What we have is a procedural change in how the determination for release is made, the point for release. What we're really talking about is a procedural change, not a substantive change in how to compute the sentences. What under the indeterminate sentencing regime, mandatory release, the determination of when mandatory release would occur, was defined by statute as two-thirds of the entire sentence, which was one continuous sentence, regardless of how many consecutive sentences you had. That was all done inside DOC. Under the truth in sentencing regime, they changed the name of parole to extended supervision and moved the determination of when a person would go onto that supervision into the courts, from out of the public view into the public view. The functional effect of both is the same. The problem that this is creating, in a sense, from the truth in sentencing and from the revocation point of view, is that whereas with an indeterminate sentence, a pre-TIS sentence, one agency could make the decision about how much parole time to take, DHA, under the TIS regime, each sentence comes with a specific amount assigned to it. And each judge, each sentencing court, when a revocation occurs, has to decide how much of that to take away. It's done, the DHA makes a recommendation, but functionally the courts are doing the same thing. They're deciding how much of that time to take away, and DOC, in terms of computing the sentence, computing how much time is available to take, regards parole and extended supervision as not different at all. The difference arises from the procedural ways in which the revocation decision or the amount of revocation is determined.
Mr. Wren, if we take your position, then it means an ALJ makes a decision rather than a judge as to the reconfinement decision? Is that not correct?
No. What it means is that in this hybrid sentencing situation with a pre-TIS and a TIS consecutive sentence, if it goes back all the time, whether parole or ES, is available to for revocation, the ALJ would make the decision as to how much parole time to take, the pre-TIS time, but makes a recommendation to each sentencing court as to how much time should be taken from each of those sentences. It's up to the court to make a determination about how much to actually take on a TIS sentence. And that's kind of what happened here in the simplest form. The ALJ made a recommendation to the court to take, I think it was 2 years and 3 months, I think it was 27 months and maybe some days, from the extended supervision time. It went back to the court for the reconfinement hearing, and the court took 30 months. The court does, in the extended supervision context, the court does not have to follow the recommendation. So we still have this regime. The ALJ holds the revocation hearing, decides whether there are sufficient facts for revocation. Then, if it's a pre-TIS sentence, makes a decision about how much parole to take, and that's the ALJ's decision. If there's a TIS sentence involved, makes a recommendation over to the sentencing court about how much to take.
So you still have the judge involved?
Judge is still involved, yes.
post-TIS situation.
If the state's position prevails.
If we prevail.
The state doesn't prevail. The guy's parole is revoked. He goes back to prison under the old parole rules. Mm-hmm. When he's done and he's again to be released, then the question comes, should you revoke his extended supervision if you do not prevail, right?
Well, if there's no parole left. I mean, if the ALJ takes only some of the parole, then when he comes out, he's still on parole,
right.
But a shorter amount that's available.
All right.
And when he comes out on extended supervision, there's still a question of whether if we don't prevail,
right.
Then you have you could have a series of extended supervision periods. You could also have that under the parole, under the old system, because there's nothing in the Court of Appeals decision to distinguish the parole available on consecutive pre-TIS sentences from being beads on a string. There's nothing.
What about Ashford?
Well, I think their point is that Ashford doesn't apply in this situation.
In this situation, but if you had two indeterminate sentences consecutively, Ashford would apply.
If you have only indeterminate sentences.
Right.
But if you have two indeterminate sentences and two determinate sentences, right. Then you're into this box where I think the argument is Ashford doesn't apply, and there's no logical distinction in terms of parole on the separate pre-TIS sentences as well.
Now tell me, precisely in this case, if you succeed, what does that mean in practical, actual terms to the prisoner? Parole has been revoked. What did the ALJ say about how much time he's got left in prison?
The ALJ divided out how much time was available on each sentence.
Okay. I'm asking on parole, the first sentence.
I think there were 2 years, 15 days on parole.
2 years, 15 days. Was that put? He was put back in prison for that time?
No. There were also 8 years available under extended supervision.
8 years on extended supervision. Now I want to know. Okay, so we're going to do your way first. Okay.
Well, the way she did it, because she has to do it this way.
Okay.
She looked at the parole and said, I'm not going to take anything out of parole.
What does that mean?
It means that none of the parole time that was still available on the pre-TIS sentences, she did not revoke any of that. She did not reconfine
him
on
that
basis.
She didn't revoke parole in effect.
Right.
Instead, so he still has got 2 years, 15 days potential in prison if he revokes again.
On that,
okay.
Yes.
So she took nothing on the parole, and then on extended supervision, it went back to the judge.
She made a recommendation, I think it was 2 years.
Okay, and the
judge
then decided how much extra confinement.
How much confinement time how much reconfinement time on the extended supervision.
Right, so he had 8 years to work with, and he gave him, what, two?
I think it was 30 months. Took 30 months out of that.
30 months.
Which means that there's,
30 months confinement, and the rest of the 8 years is extended supervision.
The remainder would be extended supervision after he serves that time, yes.
All right. So when he gets out again, under your way of doing it, after 30 months of confinement, he gets out, what's he on?
At this point, he would be on a continuous supervision period consisting of the remaining parole and the remaining time available.
So he'd have parole, he'd be out on parole and extended supervision. And if he violates again, then they've got to deal with the parole and extended supervision. What happens if he violates again on extended supervision? He's just in for the rest of the 8 years?
He will have already served time in on the extended supervision, so he can't serve any more time than the 8 years. So he has available, I guess it would be at that point, 66 months of extended supervision that he could be on, plus the 2 years of parole. If he violates again, the ALJ then makes a new decision about how much to take from parole, how much to take from extended supervision. The total amount of time that's available for potential incarceration mm-hmm. does not change. It's the total of the pre-TIS sentence and the TIS sentence. Okay. And the only question is, where do you make the break for the outside the walls?
And if the state loses, what does that do to the defendant? His parole is revoked, and they have 2 years, 15 days to work with. Is that right?
Well, that kind of depends on how this court does this. If the court affirms the Court of Appeals and does not remand for anything, then his release date would have been April 22nd, 2005.
April what?
22nd, 2005. In other words, you don't send it back for a redetermination, a recommendation or determination by the ALJ. If you affirm the Court of Appeals and remand to the ALJ for a new decision on how much time to take, and if the ALJ decided to take all the available parole time, then his potential maximum release date is May 7th, 2007.
Okay. And then on May 7th, 2007, he's released from prison, right?
Right.
And he's on extended supervision?
That's correct. That's correct.
And can they revoke his extended supervision because he was a bad boy 2 years before?
Pardon?
Can they revoke his extended supervision because he was a bad boy? He was a bad boy 2 years previously.
No grounds to
revoke the extended supervision?
I don't believe that at that point they could revoke the extended supervision unless he violates the rules of extended supervision.
Okay. So this violation of the parole would not, you believe, apply to revoking extended supervision. And that's what the catch is here.
Right.
You.
That's correct. The shorter the time available to revoke, the less control DOC has over the compliance while on supervision, and that, from our point of view, runs entirely contrary to what the trend in sentencing has been, and particularly the purpose of truth in sentencing, which was to impose greater control and greater certainty over this. So.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Grant. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Kaiser.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Kaiser. I represent Kevin Thomas in this case. Mr. Thomas has been confined in the Wisconsin State Prison System for 2.5 years of his life without any statutory or legal authority to do so. And that's really the bottom line here. It requires a complicated look at these statutes, and the reason that it becomes so complicated is because we're looking for something that's not there. And it's because historically, and the case law precedent of Ashford says, well, look at 302.11, sub 3, it's right there. Everything's continuous. Calculated continuously, it's one big lump. Okay? But it changed. And so we're looking for something, how to deal with that middle column on Attorney Wren's diagram. But we're not going to find it in 302. And I think the Court needs to look somewhere else. To find it.
Are you going to give us your chart?
I would love to give you my chart, and the marshal has it already. Thank you, Your Honor. As that's being handed out, I would ask this Court to remand this case to the ALJ. However, and much discussion was had about that, I believe that the administrative law judge at that point will have only one alternative, which is to modify the revocation order and warrant in this case. That's a document that basically says you're revoked. And on that document, it says Mr. Thomas's document, it says you're revoked on your parole, and I'm going to send you back to prison for 0 days, and you're revoked on your extended supervision case, and I'm going to recommend the judge reconfine you for a certain period of time. I think that administrative law judge should only be able to remove any reference to Mr. Thomas being revoked on his extended supervision case, on the determinate sentence case, because her decision to revoke his parole was not challenged, was not appealed in any way by Mr. Thomas through all of our writs or by the Department of Corrections or Division of Hearings and Appeals. And so I would ask the Court to take that action. And given that, my client should be released, and as Mr. Wren stated, it would be April of 2005 at some point that he should be
out. Why does that make any sense? I mean, you look at truth in sentencing. I'm looking at the dissent by Judge Fine. He says there's nothing in the statutes that forces the department to wait until after an inmate has served his parole revocation in a pre-truth and sentencing case before revoking the inmate's extended supervision. Instead, forcing the department to wait, and the waiting period could be for many years, result in the loss of witnesses, memories to the alleged violations before starting revocation of extended supervision procedures. From a just a policy standpoint, why should we accept that?
I think that some of the concern in other case law I've read about term of supervision and how do we let a violation
go. When the chief said he's been a bad, he's committed a crime. He has gone out and he's reoffended. So we're not looking at somebody that has any respect for perhaps his public responsibilities. But in any event, the idea of what Judge Fine said, how does that fit in? I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. I think that the key is that the person is still on parole. Okay, so they don't get a free pass. They still have their parole revoked when they have this middle type of transitional sentence, one of each, one on each side of the line. They're still on parole. They're subject to parole. They're subject to the parole revocation. And they might be very near the end of their parole and almost done, and counsel makes a point that that might disincent them to follow the rules. However, they may still have a large portion of time available for reincarceration on their parole case. So they've got time hanging over their head. And if, and I've done parole and extended supervision revocation cases in the circuit court, and I can tell you that a probation agent who receives an individual like Mr. Thomas, who comes off of extended supervision after just being revoked on his parole case for maybe a short amount of time for a violation, is going to give that individual some serious scrutiny, probably put a bracelet on him, probably put him in a halfway house for 6 months, because they're not going to cut that person any slack given their history of being revoked. So I think they are still held accountable, just not on both of the cases, when these cases are supposed to run consecutively, one following after the other.
But they're continuous. What does that mean?
Well, that's really the issue here,
sure.
Because
no,
Ashford says continuous means we can revoke both paroles, okay? Well, my diagram shows the same three categories, and I would suggest that the legislature took great pains in enacting TIS-2 to tell us how to deal with that middle column. And it's in statute section 973.15 sub 2M. And they make very clear how to deal with these types of sentences because they understand that these are the transitionary sentences. And it says right in there, 2M sub B talks about two determinate sentences. Okay, basically the far right-hand column on your chart is described in 973.15 2M sub B. And it says in there, all prison time served consecutively, if they're consecutive sentences. But it also says that the periods of supervision shall be served in the order in which they were handed down by the court. Why would the legislature have to distinguish what order we're going to serve these if it's one big lump sum of extended supervision? Further, 973.15 2M C2 talks about determinate sentences concurrent to or consecutive to an indeterminate sentence, which is exactly the case we have here. And here's where the obvious veto language comes in, where the legislature was trying to say, we think the person should serve extended supervision first, followed by parole in every case. Probably because they wanted it to go back to they thought ES would be tougher, okay, and that there'd be a ES agent would be have a bigger stick than a parole agent. And they probably also thought that we want the circuit courts to have the authority to make the decision for revocation. So let's put it in their hands first.
And do circuit court, Justice Crooks asked that question. He was concerned, well, I shouldn't say, you can ask. I think there was a concern of what, because that is the underlying, some of the underlying issue under TIS, and opposing counsel mentioned it's out in the open. It's no longer in the you know, parole probation is the judge is doing it on the bench, and it's before the public, so to speak. So is that different? Has it changed? Does it allow the judge to have the discretion? Does the judge have the discretion, as Justice Crooks asked?
In an ES reconfinement hearing, absolutely. They pay no attention to what the administrative law judge recommends, from my experience.
But your position is this is not an extended supervision proceeding. It's a revocation of parole, so it doesn't go to the judge.
That's exactly right. And I think that because the legislature saw there's going to be this overlap period where people have one of each or two of each, and they had to give us a suggestion on how to handle it. If going back to 973.15, I think very instructive is sub 2M sub E. Right here they say, here, I thought this was the greatest part when I first read it. I thought, here it is, here's the answer, revocation in concurrent cases. And I'm looking for sub F, revocation in consecutive cases. It's not there. Because they never imagined that you'd be revoked on both your parole and your extended supervision when they're running consecutive to one another. Because they're beads on a string. You're on one first, then you're on the other. That, and I think that is the, that's how I think 973.15 shows the legislative intent in this case.
As I understand your argument, in effect, that there are two major differences between you and the state, and they're the same differences that exist between the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals and the dissenting opinion. First, that the state and dissent take the position that under 302.113 subsection 2, I think it's 2, that you have an immediate release, immediate versus after. And that the state's position is as soon as the confinement is finished, there's extended supervision. You don't have to do anything else. That's what Fine says. That's what the state says. You say no. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
So what do you have to do to get on extended supervision? What's left when he's walks out of the prison? And the door is open and he walks out. What does he have to do?
Service parole first and be discharged.
No, but on to get extended supervision, what does he have to do? Is he automatically on extended supervision? Does the department have to talk to him, set up procedures?
I think the statute lists some things in 302.113 sub 9, I believe, that discuss the they have to make certain notifications and such. It's basically a mirror statute of the parole statute. Notify the victim, I believe, and the local authorities where he's being released to, something of that nature. But otherwise, when he finishes these confinement periods, which have to run one right after the other, he's released to parole because that's the first sentence that he was given. And under the fact that there's no bridge between 302.11 sub 3 and 302.113 sub 4, saying that those sentences on either side of the line, that magic date, are one continuous sentence, they're not. They're consecutive, just as the judge handed them down.
Okay, now, counsel, if I could, I want to focus specifically on your argument under 973.15.2M sub B, and I think you're referring to sub B2. I think you would concede that this is not directly on point with your fact situation because we're not dealing with a determinate sentence running consecutive to another determinate sentence. So I want to make it fit for purposes of the question. So let's alter your facts just a little bit and say we're dealing with two determinate sentences here. All right. The judge gets the revocations back before it, the court for purposes of sentencing. And there's a recommendation for no time to be taken on one of the sentences and 2 years on the other sentence. And I'm asking the question because I don't know the answer. As I read this paragraph, I'm not sure I see anything in here that would preclude the judge from taking the 2 years
from the second sentence as opposed to the first sentence. Am I correct in my read of this statute, or am I missing something?
I think you're absolutely correct, and I think that I've had two different judges. So you may have one judge who just views it differently and views the offenses differently, or maybe the nature of that offense was less severe, something that's considered at the reconfinement hearing, and that judge says 0 days and the other judge says 2 years.
All right. So if that is a correct read, now we put in this indeterminate sentence here. What would preclude, as in this situation, the court from taking it based on the recommendation, taking the time from the determinate sentence, and the ALJ choosing not to take it from the indeterminate sentence?
I think that if I'm understanding you correct, you're basically saying, what's the difference? So he gets 27 months from the ALJ on the parole, or he gets 27 months from the judge on the ES case. Is that?
Well, no, because it seems to me that the whole crux of your argument is that the first sentence has got to go first, the second sentence has got to go second. But as I read the statute, it says the first period of confinement has to go first, and the second period of confinement has to go second. And if I'm reading the statute correctly, and the ALJ chooses not to take any period of confinement in the first case, then what's to preclude the judge from going ahead and imposing the sentence on the second case? The ALJ has made a determination, we're not going to do it here. Now, it seems to me that if I've read the statute correctly, if they're both determinate sentences, the judge can do it that way. So if the judge can do it that way when they're both determinate, why can't it happen this way if one's determinate and one is indeterminate?
When they're consecutive.
When they're consecutive.
When they're consecutive.
Under sub B.
Well, because it'll never get to that point. Because under sub...
But 973.15.2MB2 only applies to determinate. Isn't that correct?
Right. It only applies to two determinate sentences, and they're talking about those sentences being consecutive to one another. In the example, if I understand Justice Butler correctly, is there's a indeterminate sentence followed by a determinate sentence, and they're revoked. What's different? Why can't you take time from the one and not the other?
Exactly.
It's because he should never get to that point, because he can't be revoked on the extended supervision case, because he's not serving the extended supervision, because those periods are consecutive. He's not subject to the jurisdiction of the department on the extended supervision case at the point of his rule violation or law violation, allowing the department to even initiate revocation proceedings. If they can't start revocation proceedings, it's never going to get to the circuit court judge for an ES reconfinement hearing. Does that answer the justice's question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Counsel, I want to try to find some of the facts in this case. And I note that the Court of Appeals opinion, together with your opposing counsel, the Attorney General's brief, sets it forth this way. On August 2001, Thomas was released from prison and placed on parole. The AG's brief on page 11 continues. On February 2, 2004, Thomas was taken into custody due to alleged parole violations. Okay? Now, I'm emphasizing the word parole. The state in their brief is saying that he was released on parole in August 2001, that he was taken into custody due to alleged parole violations. I may not have a complete record. I'm looking at the record here in the court file, and it looks to me that there were rules of community supervision signed. The ones that I have here are February 21st, 03, and that in part says your probation or parole may be revoked if you do not comply with any of your court-ordered conditions or if you violate any of the following rules. You know, so we've got your rules of probation or parole are set forth here. Do we have in the record any rules of extended supervision that were signed?
Not that I've seen, but I don't know that I actually took a whole lot of time to review those rules and even note that difference myself. So to be real honest with the court.
I mean, when I was looking at the statute, this is pretty simple. The statute says for those who are placed on extended supervision, you can be revoked. And that, of course, begs the question that we're here for. That is, was he ever placed on extended supervision? I mean, this is really elementary. And I'm looking at 302.113, sub 9, AM. If a person released to extended supervision under this section violates a condition of extended supervision, the reviewing authority may revoke the extended supervision. Pretty simple. But I want to know if the predicates exist. The facts as set forth in the Court of Appeals opinion and the facts that are set forth on page 11 of your opposing counsel's brief indicates he was released on parole and he was taken in custody due to alleged parole violation. So, was he, looking at AM, what documents show that he was released to extended supervision? You earlier indicated that when they're released to extended supervision, there have to be notifications and stuff. Where are the notifications, if they exist in the record? Did he sign a extended supervision rules? It seems to me if there are no rules of extended supervision, he can't violate the rules of extended supervision if they don't exist, and therefore he can't be revoked. So, it is the statement of facts in the Court of Appeals opinion and the AG's brief that causes me to wonder, was he placed on extended supervision? Where's the documentation for that?
I don't believe there is any. I don't have any that
there
the court
may be.
Doesn't
I'm
have.
Not saying there isn't.
Right.
I'm just saying
I don't have any that the court doesn't have, and I would suggest that the department's own memo that I submitted to this court as a supplement to the record shows this is exactly how they figure it. This is exactly how they calculate it. They calculate them as distinct periods. So I'm a little confused by this concept that it's going to be a huge problem to recalculate all this. All you do is switch numbers, one above the other. They calculate this on a piece of paper. It's like a cocktail napkin, practically, when you ask for calculations from the Department of Corrections. And their own memo shows, look, he's on parole till this period. Then he's on extended supervision till this period.
Counsel, you supplemented the record by the department's court memo.
That's correct.
And the whole point of your supplementing the record, as I understand it, and appears on 25 of your brief, was to show that the department's court memo that went to the administrative law judge showed that the discharge date for extended supervision was 2012, which was 8 years, and that the discharge date of August 2, 2004 for her parole. So that your point was that, and it's the same one that was made in the Court of Appeals, that the department's initial memo to the ALJ was that the only thing up was suspension of parole, revocation of parole, not extended supervision.
That's correct.
And that's your point, that was the department's own position. Now they switched on it, and the ALJ switched on it.
Well, exactly. And I think to show that if you calculate it, when Mr. Thomas is released again, he's still on extended supervision, okay? And if the court agrees with the Department of Corrections analysis in this case, you're going to have Mr. Thomas on extended supervision not for the 8 years that the court imposed, okay? It was 3 in and 5 out, but it got converted to 8 years of extended supervision. He's going to be on extended supervision. I did the math last night. Over 13 years that he's basically subject to extended supervision. Now, I agree with Attorney.
Figure that, and I'm looking at page 25 of your brief. Should this court allow DOC and DHA to revoke ES, or be extending his ES time from 8 years ordered by the circuit court to 8 years plus almost 3 more years? How do you figure that? That's on page 25 of your brief. It's the same calculation you're making now.
Mm-hmm. Here's how I calculate it. Okay. He was released from boot camp on August 27th, 01. And according to the Department of Corrections, at that point he started his extended supervision.
The 8 years started from there? From then?
Well, that's what they're arguing, because there were no other intervening cases between then and when he was revoked. And Attorney Wren just argued that as soon as he leaves the prison walls, he's on extended supervision.
Okay.
So if he started extended supervision then, he's going to that would have stopped on his net custody date of December 22nd, 2003. That was the date that the department calculates, basically giving him credit when he was revoked. Okay, so they're saying that's your start time of this 30-month revocation. So right there you've got 2 years and 4 months, basically, that he served on extended supervision. Then he's going to get out as it is right now. If we leave it everything as it is, he'll be out in October 22nd of 07. And he will serve from that date through the parole remaining, which is 27 months, 11 days. According to the Department of Corrections, he's on ES as well. And then when that is concluded, he begins serving the extended supervision again, I guess, for another 30 months. I'm sorry, for another 5 years and 6 months. I'm sorry.
Aren't they done simultaneously? You're saying, so I understand, you're saying that you're adding them together. That's why you come out. That's why you're coming out to the 2013 date. I don't understand. Just if I took Wren's argument, it basically the minute he's out, he's on extended supervision. That is true. That's the way I think it works. But you're saying that takes it, they aren't done together, simultaneous?
That's correct. They're not concurrent. Those sentences were issued consecutively,
okay,
meaning one right after the other, and the department's own memo shows that the parole, if he would not have been revoked, they showed his parole being extended through, I believe it's 2004, and then they showed another 8 years going to 2012 for his extended supervision.
So ordinarily, extended supervision begins when confinement for that crime ends, right?
Fair.
Here you're saying he's going to be confined again for a parole violation. But he's not
no,
for a parole violation.
I'm saying he's still going to be under the parole umbrella once he gets let out.
So when does extended supervision begin under the state's argument, in your view?
Under the state's argument, they believe it started when he finished boot camp. It paused for him to go back to prison for the 30 months. And as soon as he walks out of the prison after his 30 months, it starts again at the same time that his parole starts. But it runs the length of the parole plus the length of the extended supervision. So they're extending the court sentence.
That part I don't see.
Why does extended supervision run as long as he's on parole?
Because, Attorney Wren is suggesting that the two run, essentially they're running concurrently. If they weren't running concurrently, how could you, if he wasn't on extended supervision, how could you revoke his extended supervision, which is what they did, which means at the time of his violation, he was on extended supervision. Well, he was also on parole, according to the Department of Corrections. But they're not concurrent. The Department of Corrections wants this court to analyze this and say, we want people to serve their supervision concurrently, but, oh, by the way, we're going to calculate it to run consecutively.
Well, Counsel, Mr. Kaiser, I'm not sure I agree with your characterization of the state's position, and if that is indeed their characterization, I'm not sure I agree with that characterization. But I want to focus on your characterization, because as I understand it, your argument is that you serve the parole first before you start the extended supervision. And I guess, and this is a follow-up to one of Justice Wilcox's questions, and it goes to the policy behind that and whether or not it makes sense to do that. It seems to me that we're dealing with a situation where we have a revocation here. But if we're dealing with a situation where you have an individual who successfully completes the terms of supervision, both under parole and under extended supervision. So in other words, they are not a violator. That if we were to accept your analysis of the statute, it would have the net effect of penalizing the person who is successfully complying, because you're going to add in all of that period of parole supervision plus the extended supervision afterwards, which would lengthen the period of time that the person's under supervision than it would otherwise, under what I understand Mr. Wren's argument to be. So it seems from a policy perspective, for a person who's doing good, they're going to be punished if we adopt your argument, as opposed to a violator. And that troubles me.
And I think that, and maybe I misunderstand Attorney Wren's argument, but from looking at the Department of Corrections memo and looking at the actual calculations that they sent me for my client, this is how they calculate it. They say, you're on parole first. You got 27 months of parole left. From the day you get out, you serve that 27 months of parole. If you had 5 years of extended supervision after that, consecutive to that case, then you start the 5 years of extended supervision, and that runs all the way over to here. Okay, so they do extend it and look at it in chunks, just like that.
Whether or not you're successful.
That's how they calculate it now. And I think that's the right way to do it, because those are consecutive. And the legislative changes here and the history shows that's how they wanted it, one followed by the other. But
And why do you object here when he's revoked, they're doing one followed by the other, and you get more time, extend 8 years?
Because if it's one followed by the other, then how can he be revoked on the latter during the period of the former?
So you're agreeing as to the calculation. You're just disagreeing that you have this is the moment for revoking extended supervision.
That's correct. If they want to calculate it the way they are, then I think they have to adopt our
provision
analysis, and which I think is consistent with what the legislature wanted, and not try and extend them past that period of time and revoke them on both at the same time.
Now, it seems to me your argument and the Court of Appeals argument places heavy emphasis on the new, I'll have to get my numbers right, the new statutory provision on continuous, the new 302.11.3. That is, that statute was changed, 302.11.3. It used to read all consecutive sentences are continuous. Then it was changed, all consecutive sentences after TIS shall be continuous. And the Court of Appeals said that's important, and we're considering that as an important change. And you agree with that, I assume.
Absolutely.
And the state says, no, it's not important because it all means the same, and when you look behind it, look at the policy, it didn't really change anything. Is that right?
That's what
that's
I understand their argument to be.
Okay. But nobody argues that 302.11.3 as amended doesn't apply in this case. Everybody argues the new statute applies.
I believe the new sentencing scheme applies with the two creating a demarcation line of December 31st, 1999 applies.
But Justice Prosser has a question.
The Criminal Penalties Study Committee clearly, well, first of all, are they responsible for the drafting instructions for the bill in 2002?
What I understand is the 2001 Act 109 basically took the Criminal Penalty Study Committee report and put it into code. Is that what you're asking, Your Honor?
Now, it's clear enough that they wanted the extended supervision to be served before parole. Is that right?
That's right.
Is there anything in their report that voiced disagreement or wanted to modify a continuous sentence concept?
only that they wanted them to be served as distinct, well, as extended supervision first, followed by parole. And that statement in itself, to me, suggests these are two distinct periods. And we have to assume they are aware of the previous case law of Ashford. So, frankly, they could have just codified Ashford. Boy, that would have been really easy. And then say, here's how it applies to these in-between cases. But they didn't do that. So this change to 302.11.3 and it all follows with the grand scheme that they had to make this two distinct periods of supervision running one right after the other. They specifically wanted it to run extended supervision first. They thought it'd be stricter. But I don't think there was any specific discussion that we don't want it to be continuous anymore or we do want it to be continuous anymore. It's just there's nothing there to say that it's continuous. And in the absence of that, I think this court has to find that both the parole and extended supervision can't be revoked at the same time because he's not serving the extended supervision at the time of the parole violation.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Thank counsel. You. Mr. Wren.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Wren, do you know whether when the conditions of extended supervision are imposed?
Our position is that parole and extended supervision is one continuous concept, that whatever rules of supervision are put in place upon release are the rules that apply to both parole and extended supervision.
I know. But when the judge says X number of years, Y number of years of extended supervision, are there any provisions placed then on the defendant?
I don't know whether there are or not at that point.
You're saying it's not important.
Or under pre-TIS sentencing either. I mean, the judge can impose sentencing conditions, but I don't think that they do that because when you're sentenced and you're told how much time you're going to have in extended supervision, then it's left to the Department of Corrections to supervise that and impose its own conditions.
You're saying the DOC puts the conditions on.
Correct. It's no different from what happens under indeterminate sentence.
Okay. So then on immediate on sentencing, there are no conditions extended supervision. If there was probation, there'd be court imposed.
Right. And that would be the same under both.
Right. And if there's parole, then the department puts it on at the time of parole.
Right.
Right? Okay. So your position is whatever the department does for parole also applies to extended supervision automatically.
Yes, because it's a continuous period.
Because it's continuous. Can they put on additional guidelines or additional conditions on extended supervision?
I don't know whether they can. My understanding is they don't because they regard extended supervision as simply a new name for the old thing.
Well, you know, I have a little problem with that. TIS was sold. Parole is fini, gone. No more parole in this state. We have extended supervision. And it was sold, I think, on the concept that extended supervision is more restrictive and tougher than parole.
There's nothing in the statutes to provide for that.
I understand that. And so is my understanding that the Department of Corrections view as presented by the Department of Justice is they're really the same under a different name and a rose is a rose is a rose?
The difference that in terms of parole versus extended supervision is more in the procedural way in which the determination
okay,
is
I understand
made
that.
When you go on it. But and to bring that determination out of Department of Corrections into the court. But in terms of the severe, and this is where I think it was Judge Brennan in his article said, the Criminal Penalty Sentencing Study Committee misunderstood what the notion of extended supervision would be as a practical matter because they don't have two separate regimes for supervision.
I'll stay with my question. And my question is, Is opposing counsel correct when he says that the DOC wants to be able to revoke persons on extended supervision and parole as though the periods are running concurrently, but calculate the total length of supervision as though the periods are running consecutively? When I read that in his brief on page 26, I thought, oh, they can't be doing that. You know, that's, and, but then I look at your memo, that is the Department of Corrections memo and the computation of discharge dates. Now, either the person writing this memo was incorrect, because if they are correct, they are doing exactly, they seem to be doing exactly what your opposing counsel suggests. This memo on page 2 indicates for the forgery uttering charge, discharge date of August 2nd, 2004. And then from that date, they begin running the 8 years extended supervision, and the discharge date is in August, 8 years later, in 2012. So at least the memo writer here is doing what your opposing counsel says DOC is doing. Are you doing that? Are you running concurrently ES and parole, but calculating the total lengths consecutively?
No, any more than in what we're doing is doing what the what has been done under Ashford. The same language that was interpreted in Ashford was applied in TIS. And what we're doing is we're treating it exactly the same. We're saying it's all one continuous thing. Internally, DOC has to keep track of the amount of time for each sentence and string them along.
Does ES run as long as parole?
ES runs.
If ES was shorter than parole, in your calculations, would it extend be extended to the total time of parole?
That's our point, is the parole and ES are put together as one continuous period.
Let's say the judge says, I'm going to give you extended supervision for 3 years on this case. And an earlier case that was pre-TIS, the judge, the calculations came out so that that parole would be 5 years. Are you saying then that you take the 3 years of extended supervision and run it 5 years?
No, you run it 5 years plus 3 years for a total of 8 period if it's consecutive.
Oh, so you, that's exactly doing what your opposing counsel says. You're taking 3 years of extended supervision, revoking as though it's concurrent, calculating as though it's consecutive. You just said, maybe I misunderstood you or you misspoke, that the 3 years of extended supervision would be 8 years in length. That's what you just said.
Not extended supervision. The,
no,
the
but the parole
period of supervision would be 8 years.
Extended supervision would come into play after parole. So you get 8 total under paper, on
and
paper.
And they're all revocable as
moreover, but they have
like
to be
with any consecutive sentence.
Now, does the judge know this all goes before the judge, and he or she has the opportunity to take a look at it. This is a continuing question that I had for opposing counsel. You keep talking about the light of day or that the judge in the public, this all is scrutinized by the judge.
I'm not sure what you mean by all, not the parole part.
Right.
The parole revocation.
Yeah.
The parole revocation is not before the judge.
That's true, but the judge knows about it, or he doesn't. This is just some, or he doesn't care.
Well, I don't know whether the judge cares or not, but I presume that when they go back for their reconfinement hearing, the judge will be advised about anything that's happened. What begins to complicate things, frankly, is that if you suppose you have consecutive sentences, you have your pre-TIS sentence followed by, say, 3 consecutive TIS sentences, each one in a different county. When the revocation occurs, from the DOC's point of view, all of that time is one continuous sentence which has confinement periods and supervision periods. The supervision period is all one continuous period. When revocation occurs, The parole period, the reconfinement under parole, is decided by the ALJ. For each sentence, and this is why it looks like beads on a string, each sentence under TIS has to be, the reconfinement time has to be decided by the court that imposed the sentence. So you have to track that individually. You have to assign it. It's done by law. But the computation of it is treated as a continuous sentence the same way as under pre-TIS and under the pure TIS system. What you get if you treat it as discontinuous, as this beads on a string, is you get this very anomalous middle section that is entirely different from what you have on each end. And that, to DOC's point of view, that makes no sense at all, that the legislature would have created this system that has no relation to what they've been doing all along before and after.
Justice Brownlee.
Thank you. But I'll tell you, it makes no sense at all. If I'm a circuit court judge and I place you on 3 years extended supervision, that's what I think I'm giving you, 3 years extended supervision. In my hypothetical, where there is a companion pre-TIS case with 5 years probation, it's your position that even though you're placed on 3 years extended supervision, it really transforms to 8 years, and that any time during an 8-year period, you can be revoked for that judge-imposed 3 years extended supervision. Am I right? I mean, it just seems so incredible to me. I'm asking it again. But is that what your position is?
If you treat the supervision periods as one continuous period, they're additive, and you get a total of 8 years, 3 years of which is extended supervision that has to go back to the court for reconfinement, and the other 5 years is parole that the ALJ decides. That's a function of the legislature's decision to place the reconfinement determination in two different places, depending on whether it's pre-TIS or TIS. But that doesn't have anything to do, frankly, with whether it's all treated as one continuous sentence. There's no more time being served. The way it's set up under the statute is if you have these two, the pre-TIS and...
But your exposure for violation, I mean, you are subject to two violations. If a 3-year extended supervision under your calculations becomes 8 years, and that any time during that 8 years you can be revoked for the 3 years, that doesn't sound good.
Well, that would be the same as if you had a pure indeterminate sentence case where you have two consecutive sentences, and you do your MR at two-thirds, that entire two-thirds period on the consecutive sentences is available for revocation up to the last day.
The same is
true under a pure determinate sentencing case. If you have three consecutive sentences, it says they're all computed as one continuous sentence. If you have three extended supervision periods, they're all available for revocation up to the end.
So under the all determinate only crimes, they're all consecutive, and he's out on extended supervision on crime one. He violates the extended supervision, and so therefore he is sent back. And your position would be when he's sent back, both extended supervisions have to be recalculated by the judge.
What would be revoked, what the ALJ would decide...
Is both extended supervision.
Is both, yes.
Just like in Ashford.
The language for the determinate only and indeterminate only tracks exactly. They use the same language. And the dispute here is, did they set up an entirely separate system for this transition period, this hybrid period?
Even though the Criminal Studies Committee did have a provision for a separate system, but that was vetoed.
No, they just had a separate system for deciding which gets served for how they wanted the...
Whatever it meant. Okay. Thank you.
Could I,
Justice Brasser.
Could I ask one last question? When Governor McCallum vetoed truth in sentencing portions of 2001 Act 109, do Do you have evidence of who recommended those particular vetoes?
I believe, Your Honor, in our in the appendix to our brief, I included some material that, yes, at pages 168, 169 in our appendix. Department of Corrections provided me with this, which we provided to the Court of Appeals in response to their question. DOC recommended that veto precisely because, and this is what Governor McCallum said in his veto message, it changes things from what they've been doing. And the whole point was they didn't want to change it. That was not the purpose of creating extended supervision, was to change how it was computed or calculated or anything like that. It was mainly to bring certainty to that period and to move it into the public arena for the determination of reconfinement.
Yeah, but it just talks about serving. It doesn't talk about how this calculation would be the same or different.
Correct, and then and that raises the question of whether from silence you determine that they intended to change something.
Now, suppose this court affirmed the Court of Appeals. Can the Department of Corrections go to the legislature and just get a change in the statutes, and would they be retroactive?
I think they could get the change. I don't know about the retroactivity question. Personally, I have doubts about that because I don't think they can take ES and make it retroactive to crimes that occurred beforehand. We treat sentencing decisions as to, in terms of the crime when they occur. We don't apply the current sentencing provisions to crimes that occurred before those sentencing provisions went into place.
Thank you, Mr. Wren.
I'm not conceding.
I agree. I understand that. That concludes our hearing in 2005, AP 1487, State versus Ex Rel Kevin Thomas versus David Schwartz et al. The court will take a few minutes recess so that these students may leave if they wish and other students may return.